Sorry, I'm just waiting for it. Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of the Chasing Bars podcast. This episode I'm joined by ex-ESPN and current Action Network host Jason Sobel. Welcome.
Thanks, Craig. What's going on? Thanks for having me.
I'm good. How are you? Obviously, you've told me you're on a pretty tight schedule, so that's fine. We'll try and keep it quite short and sweet. But yeah, I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah, no, it's just got done doing a little segment for PGA Tour Live. Got some other stuff to do later, but it's not too bad. I'm happy to be here with you and look forward to getting into this. I know you got a lot of questions for me.
Yeah. Well, obviously, we know how much of a popular figure you are in the game of golf. Obviously, you've got loads of media duties to do. So now we appreciate you any time you have, really. And it's a pleasure to have you on. So.
Yeah, thanks. Look, I love doing this stuff. Usually when people ask me to come on the podcast, as long as we can work out the time, I'm happy to do it. So thanks for having me and looking forward to this.
I know it's quite early in the morning over in over in America right now. So
it's 10 a.m. You said that before we started. You're making it sound like I woke up early to speak with you. I mean, I do wake up before 10 a.m.
Fair. But I'll admit I'm a pretty lazy person. So 10 a.m. is quite early for me. So. But so just a little bit about your general background and how you kind of started in the game of golf, because obviously you've been in the game for a while now, haven't you? So
yeah, so there's a lot to this. Getting started in the game of golf and getting started in the golf journalism industry are two completely different stories, but I'll try to give you the shortened version of both of them. So. Really didn't play much golf or pay much attention to golf at all when I was growing up, into all other sports, baseball, football, basketball, everything else. But wasn't a big golf fan growing up. The summer before my junior year of college, I worked as a camp counselor, you know, working with little kids and running around all day. And we would get done at 3 o'clock, and myself and some friends started going to a local par three course, you know, 80, 90, 100 yard holes. And and we'd go out there and, yeah, you know, just hang out after work and go kind of learn how to play. It's a great way to learn how to play golf, because you're going out there really with a wedge and a putter, and that's it. We'd bring our whole bag so we could sneak beers onto the course when we were 19 years old. But that's a different story. But yeah, we'd just go in there, and you know, and that's kind of how I learned how to play. My best friend at college had been the captain of the golf team, and so I called him before I went back to school, and I said, you know, I'm not very good. I just started playing, but I'm kind of getting into golf. Can you maybe get me on the team somehow so I could, you know, work on my game and stuff? He's, yeah, I'll introduce you to coach. And I go down to the gym, went to Brandeis University just outside of Boston. And I go down to the gym and he introduces me to the coach. Coach played power forward for the Celtics back on the powerhouse teams of the 50s and 60s, Bob Branham, big, gruff, you know, tough dude. And so goes, ah, why don't you hit a few balls into the net here in the gym? Okay. I hit a couple of balls and he looks at me and goes, well, you're not very good. I said, yeah, I know. I'm still just learning and, you know, I'm trying to get better. I said, well, can you drive? And I, you know, I got to take my driver out of the bag. Some naive 19-year-old kid. I don't know what's going on. So, no, can you drive a damn golf ball or can you drive a damn car? And I said, yeah, I can drive a car. And I'm waiting for, you know, some advice that's, you know, going to rain down from the heavens. Like, you know, driving a golf ball is just like driving a car. And, you know, you just have to work on. Nah. He goes, do you have a car here on campus? Yeah. How many people can it fit? Five. Do you have a trunk? Yes. Can you drive other people to practice every day? Sure. He goes, all right, you're on the team. And so, I mean, that was literally like my indoctrination into the world of golf was I had a car at school and was able to drive people to practice. And so I became a varsity athlete, a collegiate athlete when I, like before I'd ever even played like a real full 18 hole round of golf, on the course. I was just still playing, you know, these little par three courses. So in any case, I did get a little bit better after that. And I kind of fell in love with the game and, you know, started started playing more, started watching more, started getting into it more. Right after college, I started with ESPN. I was working in studio production and covered the 2000, 2001, 2002 U.S. Opens as part of the TV crew for ESPN at that point. And then a couple years later, I'm working as a highlight supervisor at ESPN, working on all the highlights for the for SportsCenter and the other shows. And this golf editor job became available for ESPN.com. And so I applied for it, and they liked the fact that I had a writing background. I'd written all through college, wrote for the Boston Globe and a bunch of other places. And I had this TV background. They're starting to put video on the internet, which, you know, I don't think is ever going to work. But they're starting to put video with stories and things like that. They liked the fact that I had a video background. And I knew some golf. So somehow I got the job. In any case, second day on the job, I said to the boss, you know, we don't have a golf writer. We don't have anyone like writing for us on a daily basis. Can I write something? Because I'm the editor of a page that has no content coming in. He said, yeah, I don't care. Go write something. So I wrote something. First story I ever wrote, about Colin Montgomery. I never met Colin Montgomery, never spoken with him, but I wrote a story on Colin Montgomery because we didn't have anything else to put on the page. And so I did that, and then the next day said, can I write something else? Yeah. Boss is looking at me like, I don't really care. Just do whatever you want. Okay, cool. So for the next 4 years, I wound up becoming not just the editor, but writer, blogger, photojournalist. I mean, you're like everything. And, you know, that kind of blossomed into just doing the writing duties and then doing more TV and doing more radio, and went from ESPN to Golf Channel, Golf Channel back to ESPN, ESPN now to the Action Network, also host a radio show on Sirius XM. The whole thing's been like this 20-year fantasy camp, like, you know, that you're sitting there going, wait, really? Like, and, you know, I say it on the show all the time that, I mean, if you were to explain to somebody just lands on Earth and you're explaining to them like, well, there's this game and there's these little balls. You take these sticks and you try to hit this little ball into a hole in the ground that's like way down there. You can't even see it. And they go, wow, you do that? I said, no, no, no. I watch other people do that. And then I talk about them and write about them. I mean, it is the most inconsequential thing in the entire world. And yet I get to do that for a living, which is the coolest thing ever.
Yeah. No, that's fabulous. that's a great insight into obviously how you got the job and stuff. That's fantastic. I'm sitting here and trying not to laugh here. So, so you're currently on the Action Network. How long have you been there for? Like
about 3.5 years now. I came in 2018. I came to the Action Network a month before the PASPA was passed by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so at the time, betting still wasn't legalized and regulated throughout the United States. And so I was taking a gamble myself, to use a pun there. The fact that if gambling doesn't become legalized and regulated by the Supreme Court, So people are still betting on golf. We all know that, you know, there are ways to bet that aren't necessarily legal and regulated. But for us in the States, this has become so big over the last couple of years and is only going to get much, much more, much, much bigger over the next couple of years, which has really obviously helped the job out. You know, we have a partnership with the PGA Tour. It's amazing the fact that it wasn't very long ago that the PGA Tour told me, certain executive of the tour told me that I might not be able to get credentialed anymore because I was writing for a gambling website and they didn't want anyone talking or writing about gambling who was covering the tour. And within a year of that, less than a year, we had a partnership with the PGA Tour and I was creating content for their programming and their website. It's amazing how quickly that is all just done a complete 180. So, it's been 3.5 years, almost 4 years with the Action Network, and it's been fantastic.
Yeah, we've had guests from all parts of America come on the show, and they say the same thing about the whole regulation of gambling and stuff, like, and how it's illegal in some states, and only it's only getting legalized in a few other states. Why is that? Is it a specific rule to why?
It's all government stuff. I look at it very much like the marijuana laws, which have, you know, over the last few years, you know, one state loosens the laws and relaxes it, then the next state, then the next, and they all kind of start falling as dominoes. But it's honestly a political power play from state to state. And quite frankly, if they all looked at it, I would have thought that going into the pandemic a year and a half ago or whatever it was, that, hey, all of a sudden the economy needs a huge boost. How can we do a quick fix for our state's economy where we can find some taxable income that's coming in, revenue that's coming in? I would have thought that by now we're looking at 90% of U.S. states being legalized and regulated. And it just, I guess it's just slower than it should be, but it's going to happen. I mean, it's very, very apparent to me that at some point we're going to have every state just having it legalized. And I don't know what the holdup is in specific states you have to go through. I know I live in Florida, and there's lobbyists for some of the resorts like a Disney, some of the casinos that are run by certain entities that don't necessarily want to lose their business. But all of a sudden, when they say, well, you can have some piece of the pie when it comes to sports gaming, then they say, OK, well, now we're in. Now we like it and we want to have it. It's all just everyone trying to kind of get on the side for themselves where, you know, how can we make this benefit us? But at some point, it's going to be legalized and regulated, I think, everywhere in the United States.
Yeah, it's just, I find that, well, obviously in the UK, like, we for years, like, it's everywhere. Betting is huge over in the United Kingdom and stuff. I just find it quite strange, obviously, that America has, like, these certain laws and stuff, but it was just fascinating, really. That's all. I was just wondering, that's all.
Yeah, and I don't know a ton about it. We've got people with the Action Network that kind of cover the legalizations and regulation, like, more than I know necessarily. But I do know that, like, it's political. A lot of it is, like, just sort of, you know, it's an inevitability, I think. It's just a matter of how they can push through a bill and how much the governor, the other politicians want to push it through, and how much they want to push against it. What can they get? You know, what kind of backroom deals can they make? Hey, if we give you this, will you give me that? Those kind of things. Again, kind of above my pay grade a little bit, but that's what I've seen from it.
That's fair enough. So you got any kind of favorite memories from your time, obviously, with the aligned with the PGA Tour and stuff?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're gonna have to narrow that one down. Yeah, I've got tons and tons and tons of memories. Sitting down here, I can tell you, from sitting down and doing a podcast like we're doing, face to face in person with Jack Nicklaus, where, you know, you talk to Jack about golf and he's, you know, he's fine, he's into it. And then all of a sudden we get into, like, talking to him about fishing, bone fishing. And I mean, me and my podcast partner, Michael Collins, are, like, trying to leave. And Jack's like, no, you got to see these pictures. He's looking for pictures on his phone. He's showing us this stuff. He was so into it, to, you know, having dinner with Gary Player, to standing on the tarmac while Arnold Palmer flies his Cessna Citation onto the tarmac and, like, literally parks his plane in front of us, walks down the steps, puts his hand out, says, hi, I'm Arnold Palmer. And I'm like, yeah, no shit. I saw the tail number. I kind of figured that. But yeah, I mean, some of these things, again, I said it's been like fantasy camp, and it really is. You start telling some of these stories and it's like, wow, how did I get to do that? But yeah, so, I mean, when you talk about good stories, you almost have to give me a name and I'll give you a story. But, you know, it's really hard for me to sit here and just pick out one that's better than everything else.
Well, I'm going to do a little bit of a segment on a certain player, which I've already said to you about, so I'll leave him out just now. But have you got a good Tiger story at all?
Here's my favorite Tiger story. for years. Tiger and I had this little kind of back and forth in press conference. It was when I went to Golf Channel. I think Tiger had a little vendetta against Golf Channel because he'd always been good to me in press conference type settings. I'd done one-on-ones with him when I was with ESPN. He was always great. And I went to Golf Channel. I'm telling you, the minute I went to Golf Channel, he essentially stopped answering my questions when I'd ask him in press conferences. I would have to like follow up with how, why, when, and finally like try to squeeze an answer out of him. But for 4 years I was with Golf Channel, he didn't speak with me much. I went back to ESPN and all of a sudden we're best buddies again. And so I'm exaggerating a little bit, but this one story I think exemplifies how Tiger has changed, because for the first, 15 years I was covering Tiger, he was always, sort of very hard to get to. He would do a press conference, he'd do an interview, and all of a sudden, someone would whisk him away on a cart and he'd leave and you wouldn't see him until he was on the first tee the next day. He's not one to kind of hang out. Some of the other players will hang out, talk to the media a little bit. This is at the 2017 Hero World Challenge, where he was coming back from one of the many injury absences that he had had. And so it just kind of, this kind of showed me like the change in Tiger a little bit, and because we never would have seen this during his prime years. But, and this is, again, this is just a personal story. There are much better stories about Tiger, but if I'm giving a personal one from just being around him, that he had done his press conference and he was standing around for a little bit. I went back to my computer in the media center and I'm sitting there at my laptop. I've typed in six words or whatever, and I feel someone breathing over my neck. I just feel like, it's probably one of my buddies, one of the other writers. So I look, and it's Tiger, and he's got this big smile across his face. And I kind of look at him, and he looks at me, he goes, "Hey, don't fuck it up." And usually I'm fairly quick with a response when I get stuff like that, and you don't fuck it up either this week. Good luck, though. I had nothing. It was the absolute worst response ever, but he's walking away laughing. I said, "God, can you imagine Tiger back in 2005, like doing something like that with a reporter?" Never. I think it shows just sort of how he's relaxed a little bit, how he's become a lot more personable. I think a lot of that has to do with just growing up, having kids, kind of relaxing a little bit. So anyway, that's my favorite Tiger story personally, but there are so many others.
So I guess another talking point, obviously, this year has been the whole, I think where this is going, the Bryce and Brooks debate. Do you think this was all a ruse from the start, or do you think there was really this kind of beef towards them?
It wasn't a ruse. I'm not so sure there was like a huge beef. Bryson is the guy that people roll their eyes at. He says stuff and
me too. Yeah. I'll admit.
Sure. I mean, he gets into, "Hey Bryson, how'd you play today?" He's like, "Well," and he gets into proprioception and he gets into like wind vectors. And dude, just say like, "Yeah, I played pretty well. I don't know. Hit my ball okay and it was good." It's just like, dude. And so you roll your eyes and we all do it. It doesn't mean I hate that guy and I don't want to see him. And Brooks is the class bully. And so the class bully probably rolls his eyes at the class nerd a little bit more than anyone else. Everyone else is kind of like, okay, that guy, I'm just going to roll my eyes at him, but I don't wish anything ill towards him or anything like that. So in any case, this was never like, "Hey, we hate each other." And I don't think there was anything from Bryson towards Brooks. Bryson's like, I don't know. He's just one of the guys on tour. He's a good player, whatever. And this is all sort of Brooks towards Bryson. But yeah, at some point it became, more of a, "Hey, we can kind of monetize this situation a little bit more." And then they made up at the Ryder Cup. And we in the media probably turned it into something much bigger than it needed to be. I tried to downplay it from the start. I didn't think it was ever a huge deal, but look, people were into it, and we work in a business of supply and demand, and so if people are going to demand more on that story and demand to express opinions and speak about it and hear about it, then we're going to supply that information. So that's why it became such a big talking point over the course of the whole summer. But I just look, we're seeing the culmination of it now. They're playing a 12-hole match in November to raise money for Brooks and Bryson, essentially. I mean, this is this whole thing is going to go right into their pockets, whether it's pit money indirectly or whether it's money from the match that they're going to play. I don't think it was a ruse from the start. I don't think Brooks and Bryson and their team sat down and said, hey, let's, you know, have a feud between us. But once they got the ball rolling and they saw where it could go, I think they ran with it.
Yeah. I mean, it was such a talking point for... Oh, it still is. Well, before the Ryder Cup, anyway, certainly it was still a talking point. And then obviously the whole, oh, we made up, oh, let's hug it out kind of thing. Then I was like, okay, right, this wasn't what it's made up to be in the end. But
yeah,
it definitely was a huge talking point this year. But it seems to be, obviously, it's now into this whole match thing, which I don't actually think I'm going to watch, to be honest. I don't know about you, but...
Which is fine. Look, I've heard from people saying, this thing, I'm not going to watch this, who cares? If you don't want to watch, you don't have to watch. I look at it this way. They're providing some entertainment on, at least here in the States, a day that's essentially a national holiday. It's the day after Thanksgiving. People have off from work. People are just kind of hanging around with their families at the house. And, there's going to be some college football games on if you're a sports fan, but not really any great games that day. And so you look at it and say, hey, if I can watch Brooks and Bryson play 12 holes over the course of 2.5-3 hours, cool. If you're into it, great. If you're not into it, that's fine. I don't think they necessarily have the right personalities to pull off the whole, kind of back and forth over a 3-hour match that a guy like Phil is able to do. I mean, Phil can really dig the needle in pretty good.
You'd be sleeping.
Yeah.
You'd be sleeping.
So, but look, I don't have a problem with it. You know, if they want to put on this match and some people want to watch, great. And if some people don't want to watch, that's fine too. They're giving you an option of another sporting event on a slow day on the calendar. And, I don't have a problem with it.
Fair enough. It would have been more fun if it was like, 12 rounds in the boxing ring or something, but
yeah, it wasn't going to happen. And I'm not so sure the guy that everyone thinks would win would win that. The guy everyone thinks would win got a little bent out of shape when fans were surrounding him on the 18th fairway at Kiowa when he said they banged into his knee. If he's worrying about like fans like touching his knee, I'm not sure he's going 12 rounds with Bryson.
That's quite funny, that one, to be fair. Just a couple of minutes maybe on the obviously the Ryder Cup's just passed. Obviously it was a comprehensive victory for the US side. I can't see very many changes to the side in 2023, I don't think, anyway. Certainly with the age and stuff of the US side. Do you think America are going to dominate for the next few Ryder Cups?
So it's really hard to say. And, I agree with you. Looking right now at the team and the ages of the players, you say, well, 2 years from now, 10 of those guys are going to be back. You add a Will Zalatoris and a Sam Burns to that roster, and that's a really strong team for the next handful of Ryder Cups. But things change in a hurry. I mean, Jordan Spieth is a guy in 2018, we would have said, yeah, of course Jordan Spieth is going to be on the next Ryder Cup team. If it had been played in 2020 instead of 2021, he wouldn't have been on the team. And so, Patrick Reed's a guy that we looked at. We would have looked at him a year ago, 2 years ago, and said, of course he's going to be on the Ryder Cup team. Why would he not be on the Ryder Cup team? He wasn't on the team. So things change in a hurry. That said, I also think home course advantage has been a major, major edge for either team over the last, really, 2 decades. And so you look back and Le Golf National in Paris really suited the European team, suited their players. They knew how to set up the golf course that they would have an advantage, and I think it worked really well for them, obviously. Whistling Straits, long golf course, instead of the fairways getting pinched at 300-plus yards, they actually widened. And so there's such a massive advantage for a guy like Bryson or a guy like Dustin Johnson over a player like Matt Fitzpatrick. And so we saw the result of that.
Obviously, yeah.
Yeah. And so we saw what happened. So I'm very interested to see how Marco Simone is set up in 2023. I believe that the Europeans know what they're doing, and we're going to see holes where the fairway runs out at 230 yards, and you essentially have to hit a 6-iron down the fairway and then a 6-iron into the green, and you neutralize all the advantage for the U.S. So, yes, I believe the U.S. team is set up for a nice run moving forward, but I also think that the European team and the people that are going to be in charge for the next one, whoever that might be, and I have no idea who the captain's going to be. We can take some guesses, but whoever they are going to set up that golf course to fit their games, and I think that can neutralize what advantage the Americans have.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree about the home advantage. Like, it's evident in the score lines that have, especially over the past maybe three, maybe four Ryder Cups, been convincing score lines. I just think even if America, say, in 2023 don't get the victory, it's got to be a lot closer, surely.
It's absolutely going to be close. Yeah, this is anyone who watched a couple of weeks ago at Whistling Straits and thought, okay, America's going to dominate this thing for the next 10 years. They're going to win all of them by 10, and this thing's never going to be close. They're in for a stark reminder of just how close this thing is. That said, I do believe that the European team, it's an older team right now, and I don't know where the new blood is coming from. I'm just not sure there are that many young European players that I look at and I say, that guy's going to be a superstar. Robert McIntyre, good player. Rasmus Højgaard, Nikolai Højgaard, good players. Yeah. I don't know that those are top 10 in the world, next six Ryder Cup type players. McIntyre, maybe. But I just don't know where that talent pool is coming from. Maybe there are guys that are going to pop up over the next couple of years. Like I said, a couple of years ago, we in the U.S. never would have looked at Colin Morikawa as being the next great big star and a guy that's going to help lead the Ryder Cup team, but that's exactly what he did. So these things change, like I said, in a hurry. But as of right now, I don't see a couple of, sort of big-time five-star type prospects on the European side that are going to be these guys that are helping that squad win Ryder Cups for a long time. I think there are some very good players, some very good young players. Yeah. I don't know that there's the next John Rahm. I don't know that there's the next Sergio. Yeah. There's the next guy that's like, wow, that dude is an absolute stud moving forward.
Yeah, just speaking about Ron there, obviously he's going to have to be the kind of captain figure, I would imagine, for the next couple of Ryder Cups for sure, because he's the best player in Europe we have. So it's going to be a lot of pressure on John Rahm, but certainly the last Ryder Cup, winning 3.5 points in what was pretty much a thrashing, if you want to say that, a heavy defeat. I mean, it's still John Rahm at the end of the day. He's the best player in the world, currently.
Yeah, he's the best player in the world, and I won't say a wide margin, but it's a pretty good margin. When I talk about players, and we talk often about players' ceilings and players' potential and how good can so-and-so be. This is the usual Monday morning conversation after a player wins. It's like, man, he's really good. If he does that every week, he's going to be a good – well, it doesn't happen every week, and that's kind of the whole point of this game. But I talk about whether it's a Patrick Cantlay or a Colin Morikawa or a Xander Schauffele, and we talk, what's this player's ceiling? What's his potential over the next couple of years? I said, I usually say he can be as good as the second best player in the world, because I don't think anybody else is going to top John Rahm. Doesn't mean John Rahm can't lose the number one ranking. That might happen this week. John Rahm can lose that number one ranking with Justin Johnson. Yeah. But I still think that based on what we know, just sort of the eyeball test, John Rahm's going to be the best player in the world for at least the next handful of years. And everyone else is kind of playing for second place in that. So if that puts pressure on him for the Ryder Cup moving forward, yeah, maybe. But he kind of seems a little immune to that. Doesn't mean he's going to win every single time he plays, but he seems to like having that on his shoulders and like going out there as the man to beat.
I've got a quick question. You mentioned Cantlay there. Is Patrick Cantlay really as miserable as what he looks like on TV all the time? Or is he just, is he a decent guy?
He is.
He always looks so miserable. And
I think he is one of the most analytical golfers that we have out there right now. He is what essentially Bryson thinks he is. Bryson thinks that he's thinking his way and strategizing his way around the golf course the way Patrick actually is. And that's just how Patrick's mind works. He's become over the last few months, first of all, he's become very much more open and comfortable in front of the cameras and the microphones. I think that's allowed us to see a little sneak into his persona. And he used to be the guy that would come into the interview room and I'd say, I don't necessarily need to hear from Patrick Cantlay. He doesn't really say much that's too interesting. To a guy where it's a can't miss interview, because I just like how he thinks about, very much in the same sense as Rory, where you ask Rory a question and you don't just get a throwaway answer. Even if you say, Rory, how's life been for you the last couple of weeks? He just go, everything's good, thanks. He says, well, let me tell you, I've had some ups and downs, but really I'm feeling good about it. I mean, he will give you a very thoughtful answer, which I love about Rory. He's my favorite interview in the game. Patrick Cantlay is very much the same way right now, where if you ask him a question, you're not going to get a throwaway answer. You're going to get this very analytical, well-thought-out answer. And to me, he's become one of the more intriguing players in the game, both on and off the course right now because of it.
Yeah, it's just, he probably is a very nice guy, but he always looks like he hates being on the golf course, and he always looks like...
expressions. It's just personality. Look, I always say, whether it's, we've heard about John Rahm's temper for years, which is... maybe not as much of a quote unquote issue now as it was when he wasn't the number one player and wasn't winning major championships. But that was the one thing we'd always hear early in his career was he's got a temper. He's got to change that. My assertion has always been, be who you are. If you're trying to be someone you're not on the golf course, it's not going to work out for you. So if you're a guy who's got a temper and you go, I need to let it out before I go walk ahead and hit my next shot, then let it out. If you're Retief Goosen and you make 6 birdies in a row and you kind of don't even pump your fist, you kind of give a little smile and that's about it. Let that be your personality, because you're just sort of flatlined a little bit. No one can look at you on the golf course and know if you've just made 6 birdies or 6 bogeys in a row. I think Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas are both players where if you turn on the TV and they're in the middle of their rounds, you can look at them walking down the fairway and know exactly how they're playing that day. Because it's either walking with a little strut, smile on their face, head held high, bouncing down the fairway, or they're kind of shuffling their feet a little bit, their head is down, maybe mumbling to themselves and their caddies. And you can just tell. You can look at these guys and understand how they're playing without even looking at a scorecard. And so... that's just them. That's their personality. So I've always been a fan of, be who you are. And if that's Patrick Cantlay, which is, look, I'm at work right now. I'm doing my job. You don't sit there in your office smiling all day, acting like you're having a great time. You're there trying to get your job done.
You might do. You never know.
Yeah. Well, you're acting like you're trying. I get it. There's this sense that hey, man, these guys play golf for a living. We all love playing golf. We all wish we could do this for a living. They should be ecstatic every minute of the day that they're doing this for their jobs. Trust me. Like, at night when they lay down, they think about it, they go, wow, I got it pretty good. But in the moment when they're working, I have no problem with Patrick Cantlay treating it the same way the rest of us treat our jobs, which is, let me go out there, put on my serious face, and try to accomplish what I'm trying to accomplish today.
I mean, you've got a point there, to be honest, but just kind of to finish off, really. You've got a well-documented relationship with Phil Mickelson. You've said previously that you must have about 1,000,000,000 stories about Phil. Is there anything that springs to mind, really?
No, I told a Phil story on a podcast a few weeks ago, and somehow Phil not only listened to the podcast and heard the story that I told, which was a true story, sort of a behind closed doors type of story, but it was a true story. Phil not only listened to it, he was in contention in Napa and tweeted me about the story like 20 minutes before his tee time that day. I'm like, what are you doing, dude? Go play golf. Get off Twitter. But no, Phil is the best. I won't tell that story again since that one's been told. I don't want Phil tweeting us about this, but I will tell you that a couple years ago, you see this caddy bib over my shoulder as we're on the Skype call here, and I caddied for my buddy Brendan Steele at the BMW Championship a few years ago. The final round had been washed out on a Sunday. They were going to play on Monday. His caddy had a flight home. He said, look, take the flight home. He had a newborn at home. He said, don't change your flight around just for our final round. And they were out of contention. He said, I'll find someone to carry the bag. And I just happened to be hanging out, talking to them. He looks at me, he goes, Sobes, you want the bag? All right, sure. Why not? And so we wound up being paired with Brian Harman and Phil Mickelson. And so I was waiting to just get it from Phil. I was, because Phil is the all-time ball buster, and I was waiting to get the needle from Phil the entire day. And I can't tell you just how great he was just to be around for 18. We told stories. I mean, he was very encouraging. If you ever need anything, he was fantastic. Oh, and this is one part of the story that I haven't really told this before, but we were on the fourth hole of the day that day. And this is in 2018. We're about a month before the Ryder Cup, going to Paris. And we're walking down the fairway, and Phil said, I assume you're going to the Ryder Cup. I said, yeah, I'm going. I'll be there covering it. And he said, are you bringing the family? I said, yeah, I'm actually bringing the family. He said, oh, great. You all set with tickets and everything? I said, nah, I don't know. They're not, I got two young kids. I don't know if they really want to go. He goes, no, they have to go. They absolutely have to go. I said, I don't know. I'll see what I can do. I'll talk to somebody and see if I can get some tickets. No. I'll take care of it for you. I said, okay, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. That's really nice of you. I said, you don't have to do that. He goes, no, don't worry about it. Well, that was the last we had of the conversation, and I was not going to bring it up to Phil like, hey, remember those tickets you offered? Like, I was just going to let it go. It wasn't a big deal. My wife and kids didn't necessarily need to go, and if they did need to go, maybe we could have found tickets somewhere else. About 3 days later, I get an email from Phil. Hey, your tickets are all set. Here they are. Hope they enjoy it. I mean, it was just the absolute nicest thing that anyone could have done in that situation. And the fact that he remembered it, it wasn't as if I was emailing him and texting him, reminding him, hey, I really need these tickets. It was like it was on the fourth hole of an 18-hole day, and 3 days later, he's still coming through. So I do tell some stories about Phil needling and Phil, ball busting a little bit. But that is a story about Phil, just his graciousness. And it's not a unique situation. He does that on a very, very regular basis.
Phil, if you're listening, well done on last week's victory. And come on the pod if you want, Mike.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, shoot your shot.
Invite him on. By the way, Phil is too good for Phil is too good for PGA Tour champions. If Phil is listening, they need to make a rule: if you win a major championship, then you can't play on PGA Tour champions for like 5 more years or something like that. I don't know. He's played 4 times. He's won 3 of them. It must be so demoralizing for the other guys in the field when they're like, "Oh, cool, try to go out and get a win." This, oh, Phil's playing. Come on, man. You know, he just swoops in, you know, goes out and plays better than everybody else. It's just he's just better than the other guys right now. We're 50 years old.
I just think I'd like to go over that well documented dance he does now. You know, the advert where where Phil. I mean, come on, Phil. You got better moves than that.
Nah, I like it. That was good. That was for Mizzen and Main, the apparel company that he's worked with. So yeah, I thought that was fun. It's good. I like seeing Phil show again, showing personalities. Fantastic.
I mean, just a little shuffle, why not? But Phil, if you're listening, hi, you're welcome anytime, and I highly doubt you'll come on and stuff. But hey,
Phil, you're invited on my radio show as well. Anytime you want, if you're listening, maybe we'll let you on.
Certainly to pick the brains of one of the best to ever play the game would definitely be an experience anyway. So.
Yeah, no, he's great to talk to.
So anyway, Jason, we'll let you get to. We obviously know you're pretty busy, so we'll let you get to the other stuff you have to do. And thanks a lot for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Greg. Appreciate it.
And all the best. And thanks, and I'll see you later.
All right. Take care. Thanks so much, bud.
Right. Thank you. Right. Bye.
See you.